Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name's David Clegg, I'm the editor of The Courier, and we were here for a special edition with two special guests and some familiar voices. Joining me today to discuss the perennial favourite of Scottish independence and the polling numbers, but also Boris Johnson, Brexit, and the latest in the COVID pandemic, I have two very special guests. Both of them were very prominent behind the scenes in the Scottish independence campaign the first time round. From the Yes side, I have Blair Jenkins, who was the chief executive of Yes Scotland. And from the No side, I have Ramsay Jones, who was a special advisor to David Cameron during that fevered period around 2014. So they're both here to talk a little bit about their time on the front line of that campaign and also how things have changed since then. And we'll also bring in Derek Healy, the Courier's political correspondent, and Callum Ross, the Press and Journal's investigations editor, to give us their expert view on the issues as we go. But I'll start with you, Blair. How are you doing? It's been a few years since I spoke to you, I think. Have you been keeping well?
I'm very well, thank you, David. Yes, I usually now turn up on the airwaves to talk about one of my two specialist subjects. It's either broadcasting and journalism, or it's today's topic. It's independence referendums.
I find I talk about those two issues quite frequently myself, Blair. They've been keeping both of us busy for a number of years now. Obviously, as someone who was central to the Yes Scotland campaign the first time round, you must be quite struck by the difference in how that debate feels just now. I mean, I presume you if it was January 2014 and you were looking at polling figures on the yes no question like there are at the minute, you would have been pretty delighted.
I think that's definitely true. I think people in the yes side of the argument are very encouraged by the way things are going. And as you know as well as I, so much has changed since 2014. But in many ways, I think the main thing that's changed is people have changed. There's no doubt that the experience of the UK in the last 6 years has moved a lot of people towards reconsidering their position, or in many cases, moving towards yes. And I think there are a number of factors in that, which I'm sure we'll come on and talk about. But I think one thing that's notable this year, this terrible pandemic we're going through, I think this year, more than ever before, people in Scotland have felt like we're a different country. It's felt like we have a different government, and I think almost everyone would say a better government. And I think that's definitely played into the movement of people towards a different view of independence.
And what do you think that is? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about whether it's just Nicola Sturgeon's own personal skills. The daily briefing is something that we've heard a lot about as something that's improved her popularity, her visibility and projection of competence and authority on the television on a daily basis. That's one point. But I think what you're saying there is that it's a wider issue about governance and where power best rests.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, one of the things that was a factor in the 2014 campaign is that for a lot of people who were, you know, perhaps open-minded, the UK did seem to represent stability and security. And I just don't think that's true anymore for the vast majority of people. The UK may represent many things nationally and internationally, but it sure doesn't represent security and stability. And I suppose you're right. I think Nicola Sturgeon's been a big part of things. One of the main things in the polls that many people have pointed to is the closing of the gender gap, so that women have now moved to be supportive of independence in the way that they weren't in 2014. And I think at the heart of the debate now, I mean, it used to be in the first referendum that we talked a lot about the gender gap. But I think what people are focused on now is probably the competence gap. There's just seems to be a glaring difference in the overall confidence and competence and ability to communicate of Boris Johnson and his team and Nicola Sturgeon and her team. And I find in my own conversations that people who voted no last time and who maybe don't vote SNP or anything are certainly now moving towards or thinking about supporting independence.
That's interesting. Ramsay, I'll bring you in at this point. You advised David Cameron for many years on Scotland during the independence referendum. You were right in the bunker whenever all those dramatic campaign events and the different polls and what was going to happen. Listening to Blair there, do you disagree with any of his analysis?
Interestingly, good morning, David. Morning, Blair. There is some of what he says is actually, I totally agree with, but I think I come to some different conclusions about them and about what they could or should mean in the long term. I mean, Blair, for example, says, you know, Scotland is in a different country. Well, I would actually say perhaps one of the things that the pandemic has done is it has educated far more people about the realities of devolution, about who is responsible for what in different parts of the United Kingdom. I think the narrowing of the gender gap, as Blair might have put it, between men and women in their support of the SNP and of independence, I think can also be put down to the fact that Nicola Sturgeon is not Alex Salmond. I think that is a factor in there as well. I think, as let's face facts, she has, in terms of her ability to communicate, to run a very tight ship, to give herself wriggle room where a U-turn is not a U-turn, but an actual extension of a policy, done better than perhaps the UK government on many occasions. But if you strip all of that away, David, you're left with an emotional drift towards independence based on the current incumbents of Bute House and 10 Downing Street. The question really is that a basis to decide the next few hundred years of the sovereignty and future of our country? That's, I think, an interesting discussion. Because if it's purely based on the current performance of the First Minister, is that really the suitable basis to decide the future of your country? Discuss.
Well, there is an issue about the fact that a lot of the analysis there is based on personality and whether personality is a question for how to decide the governance of your country for hundreds of years to come. I take it that that is a relevant point. But certainly it seems that some people are considering the question with that frame at the moment. And certainly, I guess you would admit that in your time in government, you were worried about that frame as well. Because I think one of the things that we would say about David Cameron is that when we're talking about his presentational skills and the way that he communicated with Scotland, it certainly was a lot smoother and happier operation than Boris Johnson has at the moment. I mean, when you're looking at Boris Johnson and how his government interacts with Scotland, is that something that fills you with concern, or do you understand why the problems are there?
Oh, I understand, you know, why this is a factor, and I understand and therefore why the poll numbers are what they are. And of course, some people are always going to take a view based on the personalities and the tone and the tenor of those incumbents. But the poll numbers just now tell us right now, at an emotional level, in an opinion poll question, how would you vote? Now, the numbers are true. I don't doubt that they reflect what Scotland is currently thinking. But I do think, in fact, as Alex Bell wrote in the Courier just this week, you can't hang your hat on them. You know, he said the swing is predicated on the idea that Scotland has done better in some ways than England, but it has not. In other words, I think if another independence referendum was to come around and there was a cool, calm analysis of the facts as well as the emotions, we would find out how firm or not these numbers are. Now, just as when the No campaign, the Better Together campaign, was hitting 60% and above in some polling numbers, we knew that that was not a solid number. And I'm suggesting to you that 58% for yes just now is not a solid number either. There's a long, long way to go.
Okay, Derek Healy, I'll bring you in at this stage because I know some of these issues you spoke to with Professor John Curtis recently, you touched on it on another podcast, but it's maybe worth getting a refresher of that. Well, I'm interested in what Blair has to say about some of those points. But first of all, Derek, could you tell us what John Curtis's view was on why the numbers had moved recently?
Yes, actually, it ties in quite nicely probably with both of those points of view. So John Curtis was talking about how the movement in the polls suggests that the kind of two main causes for a move towards support for independence have been Brexit and coronavirus. What we saw was a kind of move in 2019 of Remain voters kind of moving in favour of independence. But what we're seeing now is both Leave and Remain voters moving towards support for independence. I think the kind of interesting question there then is probably, will that last? So if some of the sheen kind of goes off of the handling or the way the public views the handling of the pandemic in Scotland, will that have a, a long-lasting effect on support for independence.
Yeah, that's interesting. Blair, I guess that the question there is, we saw a little mini surge in the polls for independence in the immediate wake of Brexit, and it was kind of viewed as a bit of an emotional spasm, which then kind of snapped back like elastic shortly thereafter. Have you got any concerns that what this movement we've been seeing in recent months during the pandemic is an emotional reaction to what are very heightened and emotional circumstances, and it may not be long lasting, as Ramsay is suggesting?
Well, you know, we all end up quoting John Curtis inevitably on polls and things, but I think what's true is we know that the polls had shifted pretty decisively last year. So they were running about 50-50 last year.
Yeah.
In my own experience, I think over last Christmas and New Year, it's funny, I ended up in a lot of conversations about this over that holiday period with people, you know, that I didn't see all that often. And I think there was almost a light bulb moment for people at the UK general election at the end of last year, when the choice of Prime Minister of the UK was between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn. And it was almost like people thought, it's come to this. How do we come back from a situation where this mature Western democracy has arrived at a position that these are seriously the two candidates to be Prime Minister of the country? So I think people were already moving, and the polls early in the year before the pandemic came in were already showing a majority in favour of yes. And of course, I think on Ramsay's point, you know, and I understand why he makes it about this maybe a temporary thing. The thing about Brexit is forever. In the last referendum campaign, they always say for making a big decision, there are push factors and pull factors. You know, if you're changing jobs or moving home or something. And we knew from all our own polling and focus groups and everything, people were very attracted by the idea of an independent Scotland. But there wasn't really the push factor. You know, people would say to you, well, why should we leave the UK? You know, OK, this sounds fine, but, you know, I don't see an overwhelming reason for leaving the UK. And, you know, that might be expressed on the doorstep as, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, people, I think, are now realising that it is broke. And I think that's a big, big change. So the pull factors are still there, the attractiveness of an independent Scotland, but I think the push factors, not just the Brexit vote, but I think the utter incompetence and lack of strategy that the UK government showed in the aftermath of that vote, and the fact that, you know, right around Europe and further beyond, people were just aghast at how ill-prepared the UK was. We had no idea what we wanted, no strategy. We couldn't make a decision. So, as I say, I think there's been the attractiveness of independence, which I think will feature more in the campaign to come. But also, I think on the other side, those push factors for why we should cease to be part of the UK, I think those have become much stronger, and that's changed the dynamics of the debate.
Ramsay, I guess what Blair is saying there is that the new campaign in 2014 pitched itself as the safe and secure option against the risky option of an independent Scotland. The UK seems a lot more chaotic and risky in 2020 than it did in 2014. Is that part of the problem in framing a new argument now?
I think as we sit here today, yes, because we are sitting in a world that is just heaped high of uncertainties. So yes, I get some of that. But let's pick up on that Brexit point, because a lot of people have sort of speculated about, in the Ref 2, should it happen, what becomes the defining choice? And to me, actually, it becomes a choice between which union, because it would be a choice between rejoining the European Union but leaving the United Kingdom, or staying within the United Kingdom and not being in the European Union. And actually, I'd love someone to go out and poll on that question, which union, if you had to choose, matters more to you, to your family, to your community, to your country? Because that opens up, I think, the fundamental choices and debates that we would then be having, not just on the emotional side, which is much of what I think is driving sentiment just now, but on those practical sides as well, on the economic, the social, the political, the day-to-day issues. So if it's happening again, Brexit will be there, but in a much different form, because it will have happened. And therefore, the voters would be facing a choice of which union. And that, to me, is an intriguing area. And the other thing, just to go back slightly, because we're talking about the polls, there is one I don't think got the attention it necessarily deserves. And it was one, I think it was in a Sunday newspaper a couple of months ago, where it asks people in Scotland, name your top three concerns and worries and issues right now. Only 1 in 7 people in Scotland put the Scottish Constitution, independence, in their top three issues. Only 1 in 7 people. And in that comes both, if you like, this Pandora's box that the First Minister's got just now. On the one hand, it has given her a platform to perform, and many would argue perform well, because she's concentrated on COVID. But if she then, and her party then, starts to make independence prominent, as they did in a party political broadcast just last week, as Mike Russell did yesterday by saying independence within a year, that is going against the grain of what the voters of Scotland want them to concentrate on. So it's a really, really tricky situation.
It's interesting. I'm going to bring Callum in at this point, because one of the things that I've thought about how the last 6 months have panned out, what you're suggesting there is, you know, issues like the economy are more important to voters in general than the Constitution. And I guess the furlough scheme, if you were from a unionist perspective, this is something I've written a bit about in the past. From a unionist perspective, you think that the furlough scheme is almost the perfect illustration of that new argument for the safety and security and pulling risk and reward, that they were able to engage in such massive investment to keep people in work during the pandemic. Yet, as that was happening, support for independence was steadily climbing. Callum, you were looking at the furlough, the replacement for furlough, I should say, the job support scheme that Rishi Sunak announced yesterday, a more generous version to keep businesses going as the restrictions tighten over the next few months. What was the reaction in Scotland to that, Callum?
Well, I mean, I spent most of yesterday afternoon trying to work out what it actually meant for Scotland, as is quite often the case, being a Scottish political journalist. And I spoke to various people at the Treasury and Scotland office, and we also heard from Kate Forbes. I mean, there's three aspects to the package announced by Rishi Sunak. He had obviously been under big pressure to do something because the furlough scheme was coming to an end in a week, and there's still about 3 million workers supported by it. The first two of the aspects, the job support scheme and the self-employed grants, are UK wide, so they will benefit Scottish firms, although some might say it's too little too late. There's a bit of confusion about the third aspect, which is business grants to firms in England, depending on what kind of tier they're in. Chancellor was a bit coy about what the implications for the Holyrood budget would be as a result of that spending under the Barnett formula. And Kate Forbes has basically, demanded an end to that uncertainty and accused the UK government of writing a blank cheque for England while keeping Scotland in the dark. But I mean, your wider point is right about the furlough scheme and the billions and billions that have been committed by the Treasury, much of which has gone to Scotland, but they don't seem to have gained much of any political capital from it. I'd spoken to Professor Keaton at Aberdeen University about that very point a few weeks ago, and he said he thought it was a kind of aspect of devolution, that a kind of trend that had developed whereby something positive happens, the Scottish government and Scottish Parliament gets the credit, and if it's negative, it lands at the door of Westminster, which is quite interesting.
Ramsay, I suspect that had been a little grievance of yours during your time in government. I'm just interested in what you've made of the furlough scheme, because as I say, on the face of it, it feels like it's something that the UK government should have got some credit for in Scotland, but certainly on the polling figures, they don't seem to have.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, all these things get massively complicated, and you're right. I am genuinely not sure the UK government has always been able or has managed to tell the story as well as it could and should do. And that comes down to the relative competence of the comms teams and their ability to do that. That, I think, is improving, frankly. I think that the furlough scheme, pretty much universally, it is hard to actually knock what was done, because it does stand up to international comparison. And I think the extensions announced by Rishi Sunak yesterday, one went further, I think, than people expected, but two also show the complications you get between tiers of government in devolved and reserved areas and the grey area that lies in between. Not unlike the complications that arrive between central government and local government, for example, here in Scotland. And that's a debate I'm not sure that has been held highly and well enough. We hear a lot about the UK government's relationship with local authorities in England, but what about the relationship here in Scotland? How much flexibility is being allowed? How much consultation is there with local authorities here? I think because Nicola Sturgeon has taken such a prominent, preeminent, central and centralising position, they've sort of got away with just ruling the roost a little bit. Whereas in England, there's been much more of a spotlight put on the problems. And therefore, in a lot of the media we consume in Scotland, sadly, it's not 5 million people listening to the Stooshie. They are getting a lot of it from network news where the problems down south are highlighted and the Scottish government can often appear as a comparator or a commentator or a counterpoint. So it's very complicated what's going on.
I'll bring you in now, Blair. I'm not on the specifics of the furlough scheme, but just on the wider economic case argument, because I guess it's generally thought now that if the Yes side lost in 2014 largely because it failed to convince on the economy, and I guess if you were looking at it in the round, the economic case hasn't really got any better. In fact, I guess with oil price and various other issues like that, you could say it possibly had got worse. Yet it doesn't seem to be resonating in the same way. Do you think that the independent side of the argument has got their case together a bit better on the economy in the last few years, or why do you think that difference is?
Well, I think there are a number of aspects to it, David. I mean, I think it's certainly true that people just, there's a general confidence issue. I think as people look around and they see that the countries that are doing best around the world are small countries, small Western democracies. So whether you're looking at economic success, you know, as measured in GDP, or whether you're looking at things like, I think, what they call the Happiness Index, the UN's Human Development Index, clustered at the top in the top 10, top 12 countries are small Western European countries, the Nordic countries and Netherlands and Austria and Ireland and countries like New Zealand. So I think people, the debate around why small countries are doing so well, which has attracted quite a lot of academic and other interest internationally, I think plays very much into the Scottish debate. And I think people look much less at, you know, because Ramsey and I could throw around numbers all day and bore your listeners to tears.
Never.
But I think people are much less focused on how does the Scottish economy look as part of the UK. And much more focused on what could Scotland do and why couldn't Scotland be Denmark or Norway or Finland. And I think one of the things that's happening this year is, in this very weird, strange year, strangest year of my life, is that I think people are looking beyond the pandemic to what kind of society they want and how they think we need to change things. Because it's the one thing this pandemic has done is highlight how much society in Scotland and in the UK needs to change. And we always found in the first referendum that the more people thought about the future and what kind of society they wanted, that tended to move them more towards supporting independence. And I think something similar is happening again now.
By that logic, would the worry for the Yes side be that the focus would narrow in a referendum campaign to more immediate and practical concerns? The old chestnut of currency, which I'm sure you're sick of hearing the word, Blair, but those kind of issues that are more practical and less aspirational, I suppose, may become more prominent in the campaign. Would you say that was on the risk register for the Yes side?
Well, certainly all these things have to be thoroughly explored and thoroughly dealt with. I mean, I think one of the things that was a good thing about the Scottish referendum was that we did actually go into detail in all these things, unlike in the European referendum a couple of years later, and we're all paying the price for that. But, I think it's quite right. If you're proposing substantial change, which independence would be, if you're the change side, you have to be prepared to get into a level of detail. And I can think back to interviews and phone-ins I was doing during the last referendum, and people were going into extraordinary levels of detail and what they wanted to know about what life would be like if we became independent. And I think that's absolutely fine. But I don't think myself, I think in 2014, you can look to be too precise about why the vote ended up the way it did. I don't think Scotland was ready to vote yes in 2014. And I don't think you can narrow down to a precise reason. Some people say, oh, it was on the currency. What we found on the doorstep was earlier in the campaign, people on the doorstep who were saying they were voting no, and when we would ask them why, they didn't really have much of a reason. They would say, oh, I don't fancy it, or I don't like Alex Salmond, or something along those lines. And then towards the end of the campaign, the same people were saying, oh, it's because you can't tell me what currency we'll be using. And it's almost like that had given them a more concrete answer, but they were already voting no. I was never convinced that the currency issue had stopped people moving to yes, because you'll remember that after the UK parties came out saying that a currency union would not be possible and made that a big issue, the trend continued towards yes for months afterwards and right up until the referendum, where at one point it looked as though yes was ahead. So yes, of course, all these issues have to be properly explored. But I'll be very happy if the no campaign runs the campaign much as they did the last one on the currency and the economy and the whole Project Fear thing. I'll be delighted, because that will be a losing campaign.
Ramsey, just struck me as Blair was talking there. What's your view on that? Did you put it down to currency, or why do you think no won in 2014?
It played a factor, because it crystallised, if you like, the arguments of the head, and it also crystallised the confusion on the yes side, which over currency has only continued. Blair himself, from stuff I've read, has come on a journey when it comes to what the currency choice should be this time. And it's really interesting if you look at it and you bring in Brexit and something that Blair said there, and he sort of alluded to the debate in 2014 and the white paper, no doubt, that was produced by the Scottish government then. And I'm just wondering what offer Nicola Sturgeon, were she to get a majority, would put this time. Would it be, we're having a referendum slam dunk a la Mike Russell within the first 12 months? Or would it be, give me the power, and the lesson of Brexit is, you negotiate terms and you then put that to the country? So I'm still, in my own mind, wondering just what's going to be in this next manifesto that they ask for. Because if it is about learning the lessons of 2014 and of the Brexit campaign, and Blair's thoughts on this would be fascinating, surely one of those lessons might be, well, you don't just insist that this is what Scotland would look like under either scenario, but you actually prove what the country would look like, what the currency would be, what the defence arrangements would be, what the balance sheet would look like, how the assets would be decided, how the liabilities would be sorted out. All those debates that we had last time, wouldn't there be an attraction to the First Minister to try and get those sorted out first and then go to the country?
I'll put that to Blair in a moment, but as you raise the hypothetical of an SNP majority, I think it's only fair to ask you what advice you would be giving Boris Johnson in those circumstances if the SNP were to get a majority and call for a second referendum. He said the Prime Minister is currently suggesting that he would just block it while he was in power. Would you have concerns about that strategy?
I think it's unlikely that he's going to change that line between now and May. But I was asked this, funnily enough, I was asked this question on radio yesterday morning about, you know, what happens the day after. And I said, I honestly don't know what he will say the day after. And actually, that's a pertinent fact that should be in voters' minds. Because say, for example, there was absolute certainty he was just going to say no for, you know, the next 4 years, assuming he's there for that as Prime Minister, that might give a sort of free pass to some voters to say, well, actually, do you know what? I don't want an Indy ref, but I quite like the SNP, so I can give them a vote to carry on as a devolved government and I don't have to worry about a referendum. But I don't think people can make that assumption. I genuinely don't know what way these chips would fall on the day after.
What would you be advising him?
It's a real, real conundrum. I can't answer that because I don't know the answer in my own mind, frankly. Genuinely, I don't know. I think the party in Scotland and the party across the UK have a choice to make, I think, about what in the immediate term maximises their electoral position versus, you know, what might they think is the right thing to do in the longer term. Back in 2012, 13, 14, it was much easier, David, because it was a fresh issue in terms of an electoral mandate. It was clear cut. We didn't have the whole arguments about once in a lifetime, once in a generation, and all those things. And we took the decision back then that, you know, the mandate was clear. It was a less complicated election in other factors. But this time around, there is so much more at stake. We'll have come out of the EU and Brexit will have been completed. We'll still be in, at best, the severe aftermaths of a global pandemic, still have health consequences and massive economic consequences, and we'll have the independence question. So it is going to be harder to actually say that was a particular mandate on one particular issue. So I don't know what the answer is going to be in 8 months' time, because there's so many, you know, cataclysmic, catastrophic issues swirling around. And trying to know the mind of the Prime Minister today or tomorrow is one thing. Trying to know what it will be at the end of May next year is even tougher.
Blair, I told Ramsay that I would put this proposal for doing the negotiations before the vote. What's your thoughts on that concept?
The fundamental flaw in that, of course, is that the interest of the UK government would be in presenting as unattractive a deal as possible to discourage people from voting yes. So I just don't think that's a starter.
I think one of the other problems with it is it's kind of being proposed in some quarters I've seen as a way of blocking independence. So it kind of shows the hand a little bit whenever that's how it's being talked about in some quarters.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the difference between the two referendum we had in recent years, of course, were that the yes side in 2014 were pushed very, very hard on the detail. And it was very, very detailed discussion all around the country. You know, the famous currency conversations with taxi drivers that we were all having. So there's a level of detail and specificity that 2 years later, I felt, you know, whatever your views on the Brexit vote, the Leave campaign were not at all pushed on what life would be like after the UK came out of the European Union. So I think the two campaigns were very, very different. And I think there's less of a need, if you like, for any pre-negotiation to happen in the Scottish referendum. On timing, David, my own view is, and I've no inside knowledge on this, but I think a referendum would be about a year after the Scottish election. I would think about the spring of 2022. I agree with Ramsay. I think from what he was saying that, and it's a fascinating conversation, this, I think whatever Boris Johnson says ahead of the election, I think reality kicks in. If the pro-referendum, pro-independence parties get a majority in the election next year, then I would be very, very confident that there'll be a second independence referendum.
Just because you think that the democratic outrage of blocking it would be so great?
I think that's right. And you know, remember, Boris Johnson is looking like a weaker prime minister by the day. You almost see the authority and power draining away. And one of the things we know about him is, you know, if U-turns were an Olympic event, he'd be odds on for a gold medal, you know. So changing his mind is not something that he finds too difficult. I think the, you know, we will always say no to a referendum strategy is an election strategy. He's doing, in a sense, he's picking up the strategy that Ruth Davidson first adopted in 2016, which was to try and consolidate the anti-independence vote by looking more against independence than the other pro-union parties. And it worked for Ruth. And I think this is in part about trying to consolidate, hoover up all the anti-independence votes next year. It's also, I think, it's the other part of the tactics. It's also, I think, what they were hoping was to provoke Nicola Sturgeon and other people in the Yes movement to start talking about what they would do in the event of Johnson saying no. And my own view has been that I'm sure Nicola Sturgeon won't be doing that, but I don't think the Yes movement generally should go down that rabbit hole. I think the question is not, you know, what should Scotland do if Boris Johnson says no? I think the question should remain very firmly focused. What does Boris Johnson do if Scotland says yes?
Okay, and just on that, what if it's coming as quickly as you're suggesting it could? What's your plans? Are you dusting off your badges and getting ready to go into the front line again, or are you going to take a more observing role this time around?
I'll certainly be involved. I'll certainly be campaigning. I wouldn't be doing the same job I did last time for a number of reasons, one of which is that my wife would kill me, I think. I will certainly be writing, speaking, campaigning, knocking doors, whatever I'm asked to do, essentially. I am a firm believer that Scotland's best future is as an independent country. I think we'll be a happier, healthier and more prosperous country as an independent country. And you know, for that reason, I will always campaign for a yes vote. So I wouldn't be in the same role, but I would intend to be active.
And Ramsay, what would you have much appetite for another referendum? Will you be going back onto the front line again, or would you rather it just didn't happen?
What was it Alex Salmond said about when he first resigned or second resigned about, you know, if asked, I will decline, etc., etc., etc. And we obviously know he didn't mean it. Well, I think I probably do mean it. I've got a life, and I've got a great life looking after a gorgeous, eclectic mix of clients and sort of their strategy through these big trials and tribulations of the political scene in the UK. And I think I'll stick to that. Can I chuck one last thought in this section into you, David?
Yes, certainly.
And it's just this, because tides come in and tides come out and all the polling we've spoken about. Just imagine the things that we've still got unresolved. In terms of the pandemic, what happens if there is a vaccine and life can return to normal or something like it? What will Brexit look like if there's, say, in the next 10 days, a deal in terms of tariff-free, quota-free access and a fisheries deal for our coastal communities? What will happen in the very uncivil war that's bubbling beneath the surface in the SNP? Who stands behind Nicola Sturgeon if were she to get, and it's a big if, you know, any sort of damage from that? There are so many uncertainties still out there that I think the one thing people should take away is whatever some of the polls say to now, say right now, they're only telling you what people think and feel right now.
It's interesting. Okay, well, as you can tell, there is a lot to discuss, and I'm sure that we'll be continuing to discuss it further in the studio as the weeks and months progress. So for now, I would like to, and actually, I was going to say I'll thank Blair and Ramsey, but what I'll say is if you guys are not going to have frontline jobs, you're always welcome back here to give your wisdom. So I will thank Blair Jenkins and Ramsey Jones for joining us. I'll thank Derek and Callum for stopping by to give a little bit of context as well. I thank Chris for producing, and for the Stushy, I've been David Clegg. Cheers.
The Stushy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stushy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stushy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stushy from DC Thompson Media.